It was a path, the glowing footprints said so, and saw a fox sitting 30 or 40 yards ahead. Its brush was curled neatly around its paws. It was watching her. When she took a hesitant 3 steps toward it, the fox trotted further up the path, pausing once to glance over its shoulder. It seemed to be grinning amiably. "This way, m'lady." Michaela followed. The curious part of her was fully awake now, and she felt more aware, more with it, than she had in days. By the time she'd covered another 100 yards, there were so many moths roosting in the trees that the branches were furry with them. There had to be thousands. Hell, tens of thousands. If they attacked her, this brought a memory of Hitchcock's film about vengeful birds, she'd be smothered. But Michaela didn't think that was going to happen. The moths were observers, that was all. Sentinels. Outriders. The fox was the leader. But leading her where? Her trail guide brought Michaela up a rise, down a narrow dip, up another hill, and through a scrubby stand of birch and alder. The trunks were patched with that weird whiteness. She rubbed her hands over one of the spots. The tips of her fingers glowed briefly, then faded. Had there been cocoons here? Was this their residue? More cues without A's. When she looked up from her hand, the fox was gone, but that hum was louder. It no longer sounded like power lines to her. It was stronger and more vital. The earth itself was vibrating beneath her shoes. She walked toward the sound, then stopped, awestruck just as Lila Norcross had been on this same spot a bit more than 4 days before. Ahead was a clearing. In the center of it, a gnarled tree of many entwined russet-colored trunks ascended into the heavens. Ferny, prehistoric leaves lolled from its arms. She could smell their spicy aroma, a little like nutmeg, mostly like nothing she had ever smelled in her life. An aviary's worth of exotic birds roosted in the high branches, whistling and keening and chattering. At the foot was a peacock as large as a child, its iridescent fan spread for Michaela's delectation. "I am not seeing this. Or if I am, all of the sleeping women are seeing it too. Because I'm like them now. I fell asleep back by the ruins of that meth shed, and a cocoon is weaving around me even as I admire yonder peacock. I must have overlooked myself somehow, that's all." What changed her mind was the white tiger. The fox came first, as if leading it. A red snake hung around the tiger's neck like barbaric jewelry. The snake flicker-flicked its tongue, tasting the air. She could see shadows waxing and waning in the muscles of the tiger's flanks as it paced toward her, its enormous green eyes fixed on hers. The fox broke into a trot, and its muzzle scraped against her shin, cool and slightly damp. 10 minutes before, Michaela would have said she no longer had it in her to jog, let alone run. Now she turned and fled the way she had come in great bounding leaps, batting branches aside and sending clouds of brown moths whirling into the sky. She stumbled to her knees, got up, and ran on. She didn't turn around, because she was afraid the tiger would be right behind her, its jaws yawning open to bite her in two at the waist. She emerged from the woods above the meth shed and saw Garth standing by his Mercedes, holding up a large baggie filled with what looked like purple jewels.
"I am part cosmetic surgeon, part motherfucking drug-sniffing dog," he cried. "Never doubt it. The sucker was taped to a ceiling panel. We shall."
"Mickey,
what's wrong?"
She turned and looked back. The tiger was gone. But the fox was there, its brush once more curled neatly around its paws. "Do you see that?"
"What? That fox? Sure."
His glee evaporated.
"Hey, it didn't bite you, did it?"
"No, it didn't bite me, but..." "Come with me, Garth."
"What, into the woods? No thanks. Never a Boy Scout. I only have to look at poison ivy to catch it. Chemistry club was my thing, ha ha ha. No surprise there."
"You have to come. I mean it. It's important. I need, well,
Verification. You won't catch poison ivy. There's a path.
He came, but without any enthusiasm. She led him past the ruined shed and into the trees. The fox just trotted at first, then sprinted ahead, weaving between the trees until it was lost to view. The moths were also gone, but...
There.
She pointed at one of the tracks.
Do you see that? Please tell me you do.
Huh, Garth said.
I'll be damned.
He tucked the precious baggie of purple lightning into his unbuttoned shirt and took a knee, examining the luminous footprint. He used a leaf to touch it gingerly, sniffed the residue, then watched the spots fade.
Is it that cocoon stuff?
Michaela asked.
It is, isn't it?
It might have been once, Garth said. Or possibly an exudation of whatever causes the cocoons. I'm just guessing here, but... He got to his feet. He seemed to have forgotten that they had come out here searching for more dope, and Michaela glimpsed the intelligent, probing physician who occasionally roused himself from the king-sized bed of meth inside Garth's skull.
Listen, you've heard the rumors, right?
Maybe when we went downtown for more supplies at the grocery? Said supplies, beer, Ruffles potato chips, ramen noodles, and an economy-sized tub of sour cream, had been meager. The Shopwell had been open, but pretty much ransacked.
Rumors about the woman, she said.
Of course.
Garth said.
Maybe we really do have Typhoid Mary right here in Dueling.
I know it seems unlikely, all the reports say Aurora started on the other side of the world, but...
I think it's possible, Michaela said. All her machinery was working again, and at top speed. The feeling was divine. It might not last long, but while it did, she meant to ride it like one of those mechanical bulls. Yahoo, cowgirl.
And there's something else. I might have found where she came from. Come on, I'll show you.
10 minutes later, they stood at the edge of the clearing. The fox was gone. Ditto tiger and peacock with fabulous tail. Also ditto exotic birds of many colors. The tree was still there, only...
Well,
Garth said, and she could practically hear his attentiveness dwindling away, air whistling out from a punctured flotation device.
It's a fine old oak, Mickey, I'll give you that, but otherwise I see nothing special.
I didn't imagine it. I didn't. But already she was beginning to wonder. Perhaps she had imagined the moths, too.
Even if you did, those glowing handprints and footprints are definitely X-Files material.
Garth brightened.
I've got all those shows on disc, and they hold up remarkably well, although the cell phones they use in the first 2 or 3 seasons are hilarious. Let's go back to the house and smoke up and watch some. What do you say?
Michaela did not want to watch the X-Files. What she wanted was to drive to the prison and see if she could score an interview with the woman of the hour.
It seemed like an awful lot of work, and it was hard to imagine persuading anyone to let her in looking as she did now, sort of like the Wicked Witch of the West, only in jeans and a shell top. But after what they had seen up here, where that woman had reportedly made her first appearance?
How about a real-life X-File, she said.
What do you mean?
Let's take a ride. I'll tell you on the way.
Maybe we could try this stuff out first?
He shook the baggie hopefully.
Soon,
she said. It would have to be soon, because weariness surrounded her. It was like being stuck in a suffocating black bag. But there was one tiny rip in it, and that rip was her curiosity, letting in a shaft of bright light.
Well, okay, I guess.
Garth led their return down the path. Michaela paused long enough to take a look back over her shoulder, hoping to surprise the amazing tree back into existence. But it was just an oak, broad and tall, but not in the least supernatural. The truth is out there, though, she thought, and maybe I'm not too tired to find it. 7. Nadine Hicks was of the old school. In the days before Aurora, she had been wont to introduce herself as Mrs. Lawrence Hicks, as though by marrying her husband she had to some degree become him. Now she was wrapped up like a wedding present and reclining at the dining room table. Set in front of her was an empty plate, an empty glass, napkin, and cutlery. After letting Frank into the house, Hicks brought him into the dining room, and the assistant warden sat down at the cherrywood table across from his wife to finish his breakfast.
"I bet you think this is weird," said Hicks.
"No," Frank thought. "I don't think arranging your cocooned wife at the dining table like a giant mummified doll is weird at all. I think it's, what's the word? There it is. Insane."
"I'm not going to judge you," Frank said. "It's been a big shock. Everyone's doing the best they can."
"Well, officer, I'm just trying to keep to a routine." Hicks was dressed up in a suit and he'd shaved, but there were huge bags under his eyes and the suit was wrinkled. Of course, everyone's clothes seemed to be wrinkled now. How many men knew how to iron? Or to fold, for that matter? Frank did, but he didn't own an iron. Since the separation, he took his clothes to dueling dry cleaners, and if he needed a pair of creased pants in a hurry, he put them under the mattress, lay down for 20 minutes or so, and called it good. Hicks's breakfast was chipped beef on toast.
"Hope you don't mind if I eat. Good old shit on a shingle. Moving her around works up an appetite. After this, we're going to sit out in the yard."
Hicks swiveled to his wife.
"Isn't that right, Nadine?"
They both waited a couple of pointless seconds as if she might respond. Nadine just sat there, though, an alien statue behind her place setting.
"Listen, I don't want to take up too much of your time, Mr. Hicks."
"It's fine."
Hicks scooped up a toast point and took a bite. Droplets of white mush and beef splatted down on his knee.
"Darn it,"
Hicks chuckled through his mouthful.
"Running out of clean clothes already. Nadine's the one who does the laundry. Need you to wake up and get on that, Nadine."
He swallowed his bite and gave Frank a small, serious nod. "I scoop the litter box and take out the trash on Friday mornings. It's equitable, a fair division of labor."
"Sir, I just want to ask you, and I gas up her car. She hates those self-service pumps. I used to tell her, 'You'll have to learn if I predecease you, honey.' And she'd say,
'I want to ask you about what's going on at the prison.'"
Frank also wanted to get away from Laura Hicks as quickly as possible.
"There's a woman there that people are talking about. Her name's Eve Black. What can you tell me about her?"
Hicks studied his plate.
"I would avoid her."
"So she's awake?"
"She was when I left, but yes, I would avoid her."
"They say that she sleeps and wakes. Is that true?"
"It seemed like she did, but..."
Hicks, still staring at his plate, angled his head as if he were suspicious of his shit on toast.
"I hate to beat a dead horse, but I would let that one go, officer."
"Why do you say that?" Frank was thinking of the moths that had burst up from the clipping of web that Garth Flickinger had lit, and the one that had seemed to fix its eyes on him.
"She took my phone," said Hicks.
"Pardon? How did she do that?"
"She threatened me with rats. The rats are with her. They do her bidding."
"The rats do her bidding.
You see the implications, don't you? Like every hotel, every prison has rodents. Cutbacks exacerbate the problem. I remember Coates complaining about having to cancel the exterminator. No room in the budget. They don't think about that at the legislature, do they? It's just a prison. What are a few rats to an inmate when they are rats themselves? Well, what if one of the inmates learns to control the rats? What then?"
Hicks pushed his plate away. Apparently his appetite had left him.
"Rhetorical question, of course. Legislature doesn't think of things like that."
Frank hovered in the doorway of the Hicks' dining room, contemplating the likelihood that the man was suffering from hallucinations brought on by stress and grief. But there was the fragment of web that had turned into moths. What about that? Frank had seen it happen. And hadn't a moth stared Frank down? That might have been a hallucination. He himself was suffering from stress and grief, after all. But Frank didn't really think so. Who was to say that the assistant warden hadn't completely lost his marbles? And who was to say he wasn't telling the truth? Maybe he'd lost his marbles because he was telling the truth. How about that for an unpleasant possibility?
Hicks stood up. "Since you're here, would you mind helping me carry her outside? My back's aching, and I'm not exactly young anymore.
There were few things he wanted to do less, but Frank agreed. He took Nadine Hicks's bulked-up legs, and her husband gripped her under her bulked-up armpits. They hoisted her and went out the front door, down the steps, and along the side of the house, carefully carrying the woman between them. The webbing crackled like Christmas paper.
"Just hold on there, Nadine,"
Hicks told the white membrane that surrounded his wife's face.
"We're going to get you set up good in the Adirondack. Get you some sun. I'm sure it filters through."
"So who's supposed to be in charge now?" Frank asked.
"At the prison."
"No one," said Hicks.
"Oh, I suppose Van Lampley could make a claim if she's still upright. She's the senior officer."
"The psychiatrist, Dr. Norcross, claims he's the acting warden," Frank said.
"Nonsense."
They settled Mrs. Hicks in a bright yellow Adirondack chair on the stone patio. There was, of course, no sun. Not today. Just the same light rain. Instead of soaking in, the precipitation beaded on the surface of the cocoon, the way it would on the fabric of a waterproof tent. Hicks began to half-rock, half-drag over a stand-up umbrella. The umbrella's base screeched across the stone.
"Have to be careful. Can't apply sunblock with that stuff on her, and she burns very easily."
"Norcross, the psychiatrist?" Hicks chuckled.
"Norcross is just a contractor. He doesn't have any authority. He wasn't appointed by anybody."
This didn't surprise Frank. He'd suspected that Norcross's line of bullshit was just that. A line. It did piss him off, though. Lives were at stake. Plenty of them. But it was okay to think mostly of Nana, because she stood for all the rest. There was no selfishness in what he was doing when you looked at it that way. Seen in that light, it was altruistic. Meanwhile, he needed to stay cool. "What kind of a man is he, this shrink?" Hicks got the umbrella situated and opened it over his wife.
"There."
He took a few deep breaths. Sweat and rain had darkened his collar.
"He's smart, I'll give him that. Too smart, actually. No business working in a prison. And think of this. He is awarded a full-time salary, almost equal of my own, and yet we cannot afford an exterminator. This is politics as we know it in the 21st century, Officer Geary."
"What do you mean when you say he has no business working in a prison?"
"Why didn't he go into private practice? I've seen his records. He's published, got the right degrees. I've always figured there was something off about him, wanting to hang around with reprobates and drug addicts, but I couldn't say what. If it's a sex thing, he's been extremely cautious. That's your first idea when you think of a man who likes to work with female criminals, but I don't think that's it."
"How would you deal with him? Is he reasonable?"
"Sure he's reasonable. A very reasonable man who also happens to be a politically correct softy. And that's exactly why I hate to, as you put it, deal with him. We're not a rehab facility, you know. Prison's a storage center for people who won't play by the rules and suck at cheating. A garbage can, when you come right down to it, and we're paid to sit on the lid. Coates gets her jolly sparring with him, they're pally, but he exhausts me. He'll reason you right out of your shoes."
From his pocket, Hicks withdrew a crumpled handkerchief. He used it to dab away some water beads from his wife's shroud.
"Big on eye contact. Makes you think he thinks you're nuts."
Frank thanked Lawrence Hicks for his help and went back around to the front where he'd parked. What was Norcross thinking? What reason would he have to keep them from seeing the woman? Why wouldn't he trust them? The facts only seemed to support one conclusion, and it was an ugly one. For some reason, the doctor was working on the woman's behalf. Hicks came jogging after him.
"Mr. Geary! Officer!"
"What is it?"
The assistant warden's expression was tight.
"Listen, that woman..."
He rubbed his hands together. The light rain stained the shoulders of his wrinkled suit jacket.
"If you do talk to her, to Eve Black, I don't want you to give her the impression that I care about getting my phone back, all right? She can keep it. I'll use my wife's if I need to make any calls."
8. When Jared hurried out to the rear of the demo house where he and Mary were currently living, If you can call this living, he thought. Mary was leaning against the stake fence with her head in her arms. Fine white threads were spinning out of her hair. He sprinted to her, almost tripping over the Nita's Pie doghouse, a match for the demo right down to the miniature blue window frames, grabbed her, shook her, then pinched both earlobes as she told him to do if she started to drift away. She said she'd read on the internet that it was the quickest way to wake someone up when they were dozing off. Of course, there were all sorts of stay-awake remedies on the internet now, as many as there had once been go-to-sleep strategies. It worked. Her eyes came back into focus. The strands of white webbing detached themselves from her and lazed upward, disappearing as they went.
"Whoa," she said, touching her ears and trying on a smile. "Thought I was getting my ears pierced again. There's a big purple blotch floating over your face, Jer."
"You were probably looking into the sun." He took her arm. "Come on, we have to hurry."
"Why?"
Jared didn't answer. If his dad was paranoid, then it was catching. In the living room, with its perfectly matching but somehow sterile items of furniture, even the pictures on the wall matched, he paused to look out the window at the sheriff's department cruiser parked 6 or 7 houses down the street. As he watched, 2 officers emerged from one of the houses. His mom had invited all her deputies and their wives to dinner at one time or another over the years, and Jared knew most of them. Those 2 were Wrangle and Barrows. Given that all the houses except for this one were empty of furniture, the cops would probably just give them a lick and a promise. They'd be here in no time.
"Jared, stop pulling!"
They had stashed Platinum, Molly, Mrs. Ransom, and Lila in the master bedroom. Mary had wanted to leave them on the ground floor, said it wasn't as if they were going to care about the decor or anything. Jared had insisted, thank God, but even the second floor wasn't enough. Because the demo house was furnished, Wrangle and Barrows might decide to really search it. He got Mary up the stairs, she muttering complaints the whole way. From the bedroom, he grabbed the basket containing Platinum's swathed little body and rushed to pull down the ring bolt in the hallway ceiling. The ladder to the attic descended with a bang. It would have clocked Mary on the head if he hadn't pulled her out of the way. Jared climbed up, shoved the baby's basket up over the edge onto the attic floor, and slid back down. Ignoring her questions, he ran to the end of the hall and looked out. The cruiser was creeping along the curb. Only 4 houses away now. No, 3. He ran to where Mary was standing with her shoulders slumped and her head down. "We have to carry them up there." He pointed to the ladder.
"I can't carry anyone,"
she said, sounding like a whiny child.
"I'm tired, Jer."
"I know, but you can manage Molly. She's light. I'll get her Graham and my mother."
"Why? Why do we have to?"
"Because those cops might be looking for us. My father said so." He expected her to ask why it would be bad for the deputies to find them, but she didn't. Jared led her to the bedroom. The women were on the double bed, Molly reposing on a fluffy towel in the ensuite bathroom. He picked Molly up and put her in Mary's arms. Then he got Mrs. Ransom, who seemed heavier than he remembered. But not too heavy, Jared thought, and remembered what his mother liked to sing when he was small. Accentuate the positive, eliminate the negative. "And don't mess with Mr. In-Between," he said, getting a better grip on what remained of the old lady.
"Huh? What?"
"Never mind." With Molly in her arms, Mary began to mount the ladder 1 slow step at a time. Jared, imagining the prowl car already pulling up out front, Wrangle and Barrows looking at the sign on the lawn reading, "Come in and look around," socked his shoulder into Mary's butt when she stopped halfway to the top. She looked down over her shoulder.
"You're getting a little personal there, Jared."
"Hurry up, then." Somehow she struggled to the top without dropping her burden on his head. Jared followed, panting, pushing Mrs. Ransom through the opening. Mary had set Molly's small body on the bare boards of the attic. The space ran the length of the house. It was low and very hot. "I'll be back," Jared said.
"Okay, but I'm finding it very hard to care. The heat is making my head ache."
Jared hurried back to the master bedroom. He got his arms around Lila's wrapped body and felt his sore knee give a warning twang. He had forgotten about her uniform, her heavy work shoes, and her utility belt. How much did all that add to the weight of a healthy, well-nourished female? 10 pounds? 20? He got her as far as the ladder, contemplated its steep incline, and thought, I'll never be able to get her up there. No way. Then the doorbell rang, 4 cheery ascending chimes, and he started to climb, not panting now, but gasping. He made it 3/4 of the way up the ladder, then ran out of gas. Just as he was trying to decide if he could get down without dropping his mother, 2 slim arms appeared, hands open. Mary, thank God. Jared managed another 2 steps, and Mary was able to grab Lila. From below, one of the deputies said, Not even locked. Door's wide open. Come on. Jared shoved. Mary pulled. Together, they managed to get Lila above the level of the trapdoor. Mary collapsed on her back, yanking Lila over and in. Jared grabbed the top of the ladder and pulled. It came up, folding in on itself as it did, and he pressed against it, easing it the last couple of feet so it wouldn't bang shut. Down below, the other deputy called, Yoo-hoo, anybody home? Like some woman in a bitch bag is going to answer, the other said, and the 2 of them laughed. Bitch bags? Jared thought. Is that what you're calling them? If my mother heard something like that come out of your mouth, she'd kick your country asses right up between your shoulder blades. They were still talking, but moving toward the kitchen side of the house, and Jared could no longer tell what they were saying. His fear had communicated itself to Mary, even in her dopey state, and she put her arms around him. He could smell her sweat, and when her cheek pressed against his, he could feel it. The voices came back, and Jared sent the cops below a thought command. Leave! The place is obviously empty, so just leave! Mary whispered in his ear. There's food in the fridge, Jer. In the pantry, too. A wrapper I tossed in the wastebasket? What if they... Big cop shoes going clump, clump, clump. The deputies came up the stairs to the 2nd floor. That was bad. But they weren't talking about food in the fridge or fresh trash in the can beside it, and that was good. Accentuate the positive. They were discussing what to do about their lunch. From beneath them and to the left, one of the cops, Rangel maybe, said, This bedspread looks kind of rumpled to me. Does it to you? Yeah, said the other. Wouldn't shock me if someone's been squatting here, but more likely people that come in to look at the place, prospective buyers, they probably sit down, too, sometimes, right? Or even try the bed. Natural thing to do. More footsteps back out into the hall. Clump, clump, clump. Then they stopped. And this time, when the voices came, they were directly below. Mary tightened her arms around Jared's neck and whispered, If they catch us hiding up here, they'll arrest us, won't they? Shh, Jared whispered back, thinking, They would have arrested us even if they found us down there. Only they'd probably call it protective custody. Trap door in the ceiling, the one who was probably Barrows said. You want to go up and check the attic, or should I? The question was followed by a moment of silence that seemed to stretch out forever. Then the one who was probably Rangel said, You can go up if you want to, but if Lila and her kid were in the house, they'd be down here. And I got allergies. I'm not going up and breathing a lot of dust. Still, have at it, buddy, Rangel said. And all at once the ladder went flopping back down, spilling muted light into the attic. If Lila's cocooned body had been even 6 inches closer to the open trapdoor, it would have been in view. Enjoy the heat up there, too. I bet it's 110. Fuck it, Barrows said. And while I'm at it, fuck you and the horse you rode in on. Allergies. Come on, let's get out of here. The ladder came back up, this time closing with a loud bang that made Jared twitch, even though he'd known it was coming. The big cop shoes went clump, clump, clumping back down the stairs. Jared listened, holding his breath, as the deputies stood in the foyer, talking some more. Low tones. Impossible to catch more than a word or a phrase. Something about Terry Coombs, something about a new deputy named Geary, and something else again about lunch. Leave! Jared wanted to scream at them. Leave before Mary and me have fucking heat strokes! At last, the front door shut. Jared strained his ears to catch the sound of their cruiser starting up, but couldn't. Either he'd spent too much time listening to loud music with his headphones on, or the attic insulation was too thick. He counted to 100, then back down to 0. He couldn't stand to wait any longer. The heat was killing him. "I think they're gone," he said. Mary didn't answer, and he realized her formerly tight grip on his neck had slackened. He had been concentrating too hard to notice until now. When he turned to look at her, her arms fell limply to her sides, and she collapsed to the board floor. "Mary! Mary! Don't go to sleep!" There was no response. Jared shoved the trapdoor open, not caring about the bang the ladder made when its feet landed on the hardwood floor below. He had forgotten about the cops. Mary was what he cared about now, and all he cared about. Maybe it wasn't too late. Only it was. Shaking did no good. Mary had fallen asleep while he was listening to make sure the cops weren't coming back. Now she was lying beside Lila, her fine features already blurring beneath the white threads that were busily knitting themselves out of nothing.
"No," Jared whispered. "She tried so hard."
He sat there for almost 5 minutes, watching the cocoon thicken, weaving relentlessly, then called his father. It was all he could think to do. Chapter 4 1 In the world the women had somehow exited, Candy Meeschaum had resided in a house on West Lavin in the direction of the prison, which was fitting because her house had also been a prison. In this new world, she had chosen to live with some other women, all regular attendees of the meeting, in an enclave they'd made out of a storage facility. The storage facility, like the Shopwell, and unlike the great majority of the other buildings in the area, had stayed almost entirely watertight over the indeterminate number of years of abandonment. It was an L-shaped structure of 2 levels, box upon box upon box, hacked out of the surrounding woods and planted on a cement tarmac. Built of hard plastics and fiberglass, the storage pods had admirably fulfilled the leak-proof promise of the faded advertisement on the sign outside. Grasses and trees had encroached on the tarmac, and leaves clogged the gutter system, but it had been an easy project to cut back the overgrowth and clear the drainage. And the opened pods, once emptied of useless boxes of possessions, had proven to be excellent, if not exactly beautiful, housing. Although Candy Meeschaum had made a sweet try at it, hadn't she, Lila thought. She walked around the box, which was filled with the natural light that came through the open bay door. There was a nicely made bed in the middle of the room, draped in a glossy red comforter that picked up the daylight. Hung on the windowless wall was a framed seascape, fair skies and a length of rocky coast. It had perhaps been scavenged from the original stored contents of the pod. In the corner was a rocking chair, and on the floor beside the chair was a basket of yarn punctured by 2 brass needles. Another basket nearby contained pairs of expertly knitted socks, examples of her work. "What do you think?" Coates had lingered outside the box to smoke. Cigarettes, wrapped in foil and cellophane, were another of the things that had lasted quite well. The warden, former warden, had grown her hair out, allowing it to go white. The way it spread down to her narrow shoulders gave her a prophetic look, as if she had been wandering in the desert in search of her tribe. Lila thought it suited her. "I like what you've done with your hair." "Thanks, but I was referring to the woman who ought to be here, but suddenly isn't." Candy Meeschaum was one of 4 women who had lately vanished, counting Essie. Lila had interviewed a number of other women who lived in the neighboring pods. Candy had been seen happily rocking in her chair, knitting, and 10 minutes afterward, she was nowhere. The pod was on the 2nd floor of the storage complex, close to the middle, and yet not a single person had seen her slip away, a good-sized woman with a bad limp. It wasn't inconceivable that she'd managed such a disappearance, but it was improbable. Her neighbors described Candy as cheerful and happy. One of them, who had known her before in the old world, used the word reborn.
She evinced great pride in her crafts and in her pretty little decorated box of a home. More than one person mentioned that she referred to her home as the apartment of her dreams, without a crumb of irony.
"I don't see anything definitive, nothing I'd want to take to court," Lila said.
She guessed, however, that what had happened was what had occurred with Essie. There one second, gone the next. Poof. Abracadabra.
"Same thing, isn't it?"
Janice, who had been looking right at Essie, reported seeing a tiny flash, no bigger than a lighter flame, and then nothing. The space that the woman had filled was empty. Janice's eyes had failed to detect the transformation or disintegration or whatever phenomenon had occurred. It was too quick for the eye. It was, the warden said, as if Essie had been turned off like a light bulb, except not even a filament dimmed that quickly.
"Could be," Lila said.
God, she sounded like her lost husband.
"She's dead," Janice said.
"In the other world.
Don't you think so?"
A moth perched on the wall above the rocking chair. Lila held out her hand. The moth fluttered to it, landing on the fingernail of her index finger. Lila smelled a faint odor of burn.
"Could be," she repeated.
For the moment, this Clintism was all she dared to say.
"We ought to go back and see the ladies off."
"Crazy idea," Janice grumbled. "We've got enough to do without exploring."
Lila smiled.
"Does that mean you wish you were going?"
Mimicking Lila, ex-warden Coates said,
"Could be."
2. On Main Street, a patrol was about to set off for a look at the world beyond dueling. There were a half-dozen women in the group, and they'd packed a pair of the golf carts with supplies. Millie Olson, an officer from the prison, had volunteered to take the lead. To this point, no one had ventured much beyond the old town lines. No airplanes or helicopters had flown overhead, no fires had burned in the distance, and no voices had surfaced on the bands of the emergency radios they'd cranked up. It reinforced in Lila that sense of incompleteness she'd felt from the beginning. The world they inhabited now seemed like a reproduction, almost like a scene inside a snow globe, only without the snow. Lila and Janice arrived in time to watch the final preparations. A former prisoner named Nell Seeger crouched on the ground by one of the golf carts, humming to herself as she checked the air pressure on the tires. Millie was sifting through the packs loaded onto a trailer hitched to the back, making last-minute double checks of the supplies. Sleeping bags, freeze-dried food, clean water, clothes, a couple of toy walkie-talkies that had been found sealed in plastic and actually functioned, somewhat. A couple of rifles that Lila herself had cleaned up, first aid kits. There was an atmosphere of excitement and good humor. There were laughter and high fives. Someone asked Millie Olson what she'd do if they ran into a bear.
"Tame it," she deadpanned, not glancing up from the pack she was digging through.
This earned a round of laughs from the onlookers.
"Did you know her?"
Lila asked Janice.
"You know, before?"
They were under a sidewalk awning, shoulder to shoulder in winter coats. Their breath steamed.
"Shit, I was her damn boss."
"Not Millie, Candy Meacham."
"No, did you?"
"Yes," said Lila.
"And?"
"She was a domestic abuse victim. Her husband beat her. A lot. That's why she limped. He was a total asshole, a mechanic who made his real money selling guns. Ran a bit with the Griners, or so it was rumored. We never managed to clip him for anything. He used his tools on her. They lived out on West Lavin in a house that was falling down around their ears. I'm not surprised she didn't want to try to fix the place up. Wouldn't have been any point. Neighbors called us out more than once, heard her screaming. But she wouldn't give us a word. Afraid of reprisals. Lucky he never killed her."
"I think he probably did."
The warden squinted at Lila.
"Do you mean what I think you mean?
Walk with me." They strolled along the ruins of the sidewalk, stepping over weed-choked fissures, detouring around asphalt chunks. The little park that faced the broken remains of the municipal building had been salvaged, trimmed, and swept.
Here the only sign of time's passage was the toppled statue of some long-deceased town dignitary. A massive elm branch, storm-tossed, surely, had knocked him off his perch. The branch had been dragged away and chipped, but the dignitary was so heavy no one had done anything about him yet. He had gone down at an acute angle from the plinth, his top hat dug into the ground and his boots to the sky. Lila had seen little girls run up him, using his backside like a ramp, laughing wildly. Janice said, "You think her son-of-a-bitch husband torched her in her cocoon?" Lila didn't answer directly. "Has anyone mentioned feeling dizzy to you? Nauseated? Comes on very suddenly, and then after a couple of hours it goes?" Lila had felt this herself a couple of times. Rita Coombs had mentioned a similar experience. So had Mrs. Ransom and Molly. "Yes," said Janice. "Just about everyone I know has mentioned it. Like being spun around without being spun. I don't know if you know Nadine Hicks, wife of my colleague at the prison." "Met her at a couple of community potlucks," said Lila, and wrinkled her nose. "Yeah, she hardly ever missed. And wasn't missed when she did, if you know what I mean. Anyway, she claims to have that vertigo thing just about all the time." "Okay, keep that in mind. Now think about the mass burnings. You know about those?" "Not personally. I'm like you, I came relatively early. But I've heard the newer arrivals talk about seeing it on the news. Men burning women in their cocoons." "There you go," Lila said. "Oh," Janice replied, getting the drift. "Oh, shit." "Oh, shit covers it all right. At first I thought, hoped, that maybe it was some sort of misinterpretation on the part of the newer arrivals. They'd been sleep-deprived, of course, and distressed, and maybe they saw something on television that they thought was cocoons being burned, but was actually something else." Lila inhaled deeply of the late fall air. "It was so crisp and clean it made you feel taller. No exhaust smells, no coal trucks." "That instinct, to doubt what women say, it's always there. To find some reason not to take their word. Men do it, but we do too. I do it." "You're too hard on yourself." "And I saw it coming. I talked about it with Terry Coombs not more than 3 or 4 hours before I fell asleep in the old world. Women reacted when their cocoons were torn. They were dangerous. They fought. They killed. It doesn't surprise me that a lot of men might see the situation as an opportunity or a precaution or the pretext they'd always wanted to light a few people on fire." Janice offered a slanted smile. "And I get accused of taking a less than sunny view of the human race." "Someone burned Essie, Janice. Back in our world. Who knows who. And someone burned Candy Meeschaum. Was her hubby upset because his punching bag fell asleep on him? He'd definitely be the first person I'd question if I was there." Lila sat down on the fallen statue. "And the dizziness? I'm pretty sure that's also because of what's happening back there. Someone moving us around like furniture. Right before Essie was burned, she was in a low mood. I'm guessing that maybe someone moved her a bit before lighting her up, and it was the vertigo that had her down." "Pretty sure you've got your ass on Dooling's first mayor," said Janice. "He can take it. Someone washed his underwear for him. This is our new honorary bench." Lila realized she was furious. What had Essie or Candy Meeschaum ever done, except finally find a few months of happiness out of the entirety of their rotten lives? Happiness that had come at the price of nothing more than a few dolls and a converted storage space with no windows. And men had burned them. She was sure of it. That was how their story ended. When you died there, you died here, too. Men had ripped them right out of the world, right out of two worlds. Men. There seemed to be no escape from them. Janice must have read her thoughts, or more likely, her face. "My husband Archie was a good guy, supported everything I ever did." "Yeah, but he died young. You might not have felt that way if he'd stuck around." It was an awful thing to say, but Lila didn't regret it. For some reason, an old Amish saying occurred to her. "Kissin' don't last, cookin' do." You could say that about a lot of things when it came to the wedded state. Honesty, respect, Simple kindness, even.
Coates gave no sign of offense.
Clint was that bad a husband?
He was better than Candy Meeshaum's.
Low bar, Janice said.
Never mind. I'll just sit here and treasure the gilded memory of my husband, who had the decency to pop off before he became a shit.
Lila let her head loll back.
Maybe I deserved that.
It was another sunny day, but there were gray clouds to the north, miles of them.
Well, was he that bad a husband?
No, Clint was a good husband, and a good father. He pulled his weight. He loved me, I never doubted that. But there was a lot he never told me about himself. Things I shouldn't have had to find out in ways that made me feel bad about myself. Clint talked the talk about openness and support, talked until his face turned blue, but when you got below the surface, he was your basic Marlboro man. It's worse, I think, than being lied to. A lie indicates a certain degree of respect. I'm pretty sure he was carrying a bag of stuff, real heavy stuff, that he thought I was just too delicate to help him with. I'd rather be lied to than condescended to.
What do you mean by a bag of stuff?
He grew up rough. I think he fought his way out, and I mean that literally. I've seen the way he rubs his knuckles when he's preoccupied or upset. But he doesn't talk about it. I've asked, and he does the Marlboro man thing.
Lila glanced at Coates and read some variety of unease in her expression.
You know what I mean, don't you, from being around him?
I suppose I do.
Clint has another side, a harder side, angrier. I didn't come to see it clearly until recently.
It pisses me off. But you know what's worse? It's left me feeling kind of disheartened.
Janice was using a twig to poke bits of caked mud off the face of the statue.
I can see how that would dishearten a person.
The golf cart started to move away, followed by their small, tarp-draped trailers of supplies. The procession moved out of sight and then reappeared for a couple of minutes where the road ascended to higher ground before disappearing for good.
Lila and Janice switched to other topics. The ongoing repairs to the houses on Smith. The two beautiful horses that had been corralled and taught, or perhaps retaught, how to take riders. And the wonder Magda Dubček and those two former prisoners claimed to be on the verge of bringing to fruition. If they could get more juice, more solar panels, clean running water seemed to be a foreseeable possibility. Indoor plumbing, the American dream. It was dusk before they were talked out, and never once did the subject of Clint, of Jared, of Archie, of Candy Meeshaum's husband, of Jesus Christ, or of any other man, again arise to trouble their discourse.
3. They didn't talk about Evie, but Lila had not forgotten her. She had not forgotten about the suggestive timing of Eve Black's appearance in dueling, or her strange, knowing talk, or the webbed tracks in the woods near Truman Mayweather's trailer. She had not forgotten about where those tracks had brought her, either, to the amazing tree, driving up into the sky on its countless roots and intertwined trunks. As for the animals that had appeared from around the tree, the white tiger, the snake, the peacock, and the fox, Lila remembered them too. Her mental picture of the spiraling roots of the tree, like the cords for a giant's sneakers, the way they wound around each other, recurred often. It was so perfect, so majestic, the plan of its being so right. Had Evie come from the tree? Or had the tree come from Evie? And the women of our place, were they dreamers? Or were they the dream?
4. Icy rain pelted our place for 48 hours, snapping tree branches, pouring chilly slop through the holes in roofs, filling the streets and walks with cloudy puddles. Lila, stretched in her tent, occasionally put aside the book she was reading to kick at the walls and break off the frozen coating that had formed on the vinyl. The sound was like breaking glass. Before, she'd switched from paper books to an e-reader, little suspecting that the world would break down and make such things obsolete. There were still books in her house, though, and a few of them weren't moldy. When she finished the one she was reading, she ventured from her tent in the front yard to the wreckage of her home. It was too depressing, too redolent of her son and husband, for Lila to imagine living in it, but she hadn't been able to bring herself to move away. The slicks of rain sliding down the interior walls glistened in the beam of her crank flashlight. The rain sounded like an ocean being stirred. From a shelf at the back of the living room, Lila picked out a damp mystery novel and started to return the way she had come. The beam caught an odd, parchment-colored leaf lying on the rotted seat of a stool by the kitchen counter. Lila picked it up. It was a note from Anton, the information for his tree guy, to deal with the Dutch elm in the backyard. She studied the note for a long time, stunned by it, by the sudden closeness of that other life. Her real life? Her previous life? Which appeared like a child darting out between parked cars and into traffic. 5. The exploration party had been gone a week when Celia Frode returned on foot, splattered in mud from head to toe. She was alone. 6. Celia said that beyond Dueling Correctional, in the direction of the little neighboring town of Maylock, the roads had become impassable. Every tree they cleared from the highway only got them a few yards before they came to the next one. It was easier to leave the golf carts and hike. There was no one in Maylock when they got there, and no sign of recent life. The buildings and houses were like the ones in Dueling, overgrown in states of greater and lesser disrepair, a few burned by fires. And the road above Door's Hollow Stream, which was now a swollen river with sunken cars for shoals, had collapsed. Probably they should have turned around then, Celia conceded. They'd scavenged useful supplies from the grocery store and other businesses in Maylock. But they got to talking about the movie theater in the small town of Eagle that was another 10 miles off, and how great it would be for the kids if they came back with a film projector. Magda had assured them that their big generator would be up to such tasks. They still had that new Star Wars movie playing there, Celia said, and added wryly, "You know, Chief, the one where the girl's the hero." Lila didn't correct the chief. It had turned out to be remarkably difficult to quit being a cop. Go on, Celia. The exploring party crossed the Door's Hollow Stream at a bridge that was still intact, and picked up a mountain road called Lionhead Way that seemed to offer a shortcut to Eagle. The map they'd been using, borrowed from the remains of the Dueling Public Library, showed an old, unnamed coal company road curling off near the top of the mountain. The company road could take them to the interstate, and from there the going would be easy. But the map turned out to be outdated. Lionhead Way now dead-ended at a plateau, where stood that dreary place of male incarceration called Lionhead Prison. The company road they had been hoping to find had been plowed under during the construction of the prison. Because it was late in the day, rather than attempt to backtrack the narrow, broken decline off the mountain in the dark, they had decided to camp at the prison and start fresh in the morning. Lila was all too familiar with Lionhead Prison. It was the maximum security facility where she had anticipated the Griner brothers would spend the next 25 or so years. Janice Coates, also present for Celia's retelling, had a brief verdict on the prison. "That place, nasty." The Head, as it was called by the men imprisoned there, had been in the media a great deal before Aurora. A rare story of successful land reclamation on the site of a mountaintop removal. After Ulysses Energy Solutions finished deforesting and blasting away the top of the mountain to mine the coal beneath, it restored the land by pulling debris up and flattening it out. The oft-promoted idea was that, instead of viewing the mountaintops as destroyed, the public ought to see them as having been opened up. Newly flattened land was newly buildable land. Although the majority of the state's population supported the coal industry, few failed to recognize this for the bunkum it was. These wonderfully useful new plateaus were generally situated in the middle of nowhere, and often came attended by impoundments of slurry waste or chemical containment ponds, which were not the sort of neighbors anyone wanted. But a prison was uniquely suitable for backwoods reclamation. and no one had been particularly concerned about the possible environmental dangers that its residents might face. That was how Lionhead Mountain had become the setting for Lionhead Maximum Security Prison. The prison gate, Celia said, had been open, and the front doors, too. She, Millie, Nell Seeger, and the others had gone in. Most of the exploration party from our place consisted of recently released prison inmates and personnel, and they were curious about how the other half had lived. All things being equal, it was pretty comfortable, as much as it reeked from being shut up, and although there were some fissures in the floors and walls, it was dry, and the gear in every cell looked new. Some deja vu, conceded Celia, but kind of funny too, you know. Their last night had been calm. In the morning, Celia had trekked down the mountain a ways, searching for a trail that might cut off some of the hike and save them having to go all the way down the longer, circuitous route to Eagle. To Celia's surprise, she'd received a call on her toy walkie-talkie.
Celia, we think we see someone.
It was Nell.
What?
Celia had replied.
Say again? We're inside the prison. The windows at the end of their version of Broadway are all fogged, but there's a woman in one of the solitary confinement cells. She's lying under a yellow blanket. It looks like she's moving. Millie's trying to find a way to get the door to release without the power, so...
That's where the transmission ended. A vast rumble in the earth startled Celia. She held out her hands trying to balance. The toy walkie flew out of her hand and shattered on the ground. Returning to the top of the road, lungs burning and legs shaking, Celia went through the prison gate. Powder sifted through the air like snow. She had to cover her mouth to keep from choking. What she saw was hard to process and even harder to accept. The terrain was shattered, heaved up in clefts as if in the aftermath of an earthquake. Displaced dirt hung in the air. Celia stumbled to her knees several times, eyes slitted almost shut, reaching for anything solid. Gradually, the rectangular shape of the Lionhead intake unit, 2 stories high, emerged, and then nothing else. There was no more land behind the intake unit, and no more prison. The plateau had crumbled and given way. The new max security facility had gone down the back of the mountain like a great stone child down a slide. Intake was now no more than a film prop, all front and no back. Celia didn't dare go all the way to the edge to look down, but she glimpsed a few pieces of wreckage far below. Massive cement blocks jumbled at the foot, amid a swamp of dust particles.
"So I came back by myself," said Celia, "as fast as I could."
She inhaled and scratched a clean place in the mud on her cheek. The listeners, a dozen women who had hurried to their meeting place at the Shopwell when word spread that she was back, were silent. The others weren't going to return.
"I recall reading that there was some controversy about the fill under that overgrown jailhouse," said Janice. "Something about how the ground was too soft for the weight. People saying the coal company cut corners when they were packing it down. State engineers were looking into it."
Celia let her breath go, a long sigh, and continued absently.
"Nell and I always kept it casual. I didn't expect it to last outside of prison."
She sniffed, just once.
"So I probably shouldn't feel so blue, but there it is. I feel blue as hell."
There was silence. Then Lila said, "I need to go there." Tiffany Jones said,
"Want company?"
7. What they were doing was foolish, Coates said.
"Fucking foolish, Lila, to go off and play around in an avalanche."
She had walked with Lila and Tiffany Jones as far as Balls Hill Road. The two expeditionaries were leading a pair of horses.
"We're not going to play around in an avalanche," Lila said. "We're going to play around in the wreckage from an avalanche."
"And see if someone is still alive in there,"
Tiffany added.
"Are you kidding?"
Janice's nose was beet red in the cold. She appeared even more oracular, her white hair floating out behind her, the color in her raw bone cheeks as bright as road flares. All that was missing was the gnarled staff and a bird of prey to perch on her shoulder.
"They went down the side of a mountain," and the prison landed on top of them. They're dead. And if they saw a woman in there, she's dead too.
I know that, said Lila. But if they did see a woman in Lionhead, it means there are